SAS, or the Society for Awareness in Science, is a group of undergraduates, he's a professor of physics here at Cornell, and I don't know, other things, he was on the board of the American Physical Society feasibility report on directed energy weapons. He's going to talk today about his experiences consulting for the military in the 60s and his other interactions with the government.
Well, I gather from Chris at least that you're more interested in sociology than history, so I won't try to give you a history of science and the military in the 60s, but I'll just absolutely purely give you my autobiography, or at least those bits of it that are relevant. So I will try and do something relatively brief in order to then have questions, because I'm really not quite sure which aspects you're most interested in. But at least some of the questions I gathered already that you or some of you are interested in are essentially three. One of them is sort of what made you as an individual decide to work directly or indirectly for the Defense Department. Why did you choose whatever particular outfit you did choose to work in, and how and when did you leave and why? So I gather that's sort of one question you're interested in. The other one is sort of why do these outfits choose some individuals, and having chosen them, do they listen to them or not? And then I gather the third question is sort of now with 20 years of hindsight, do you feel you were right in doing it? And if so, which? I mean, can you be both right in having gone in, and can you still be right in having gone out, etc.? So I gather that's at least some of the questions. But besides answering those, I'll try and give you sort of my whole life's history, with a sociology in mind. Before about 1950, I wasn't in this country. I lived in Australia and Britain. There was nothing very much in my scientific upbringing that had much to do with the military or even politics. There was a slightly socialist Association of Scientific Workers, which I belong to, but nothing very severe. Similarly, in Britain, there was nothing very severe except something indirectly related to the military and security clearance, namely Klaus Fuchs, the sort of best known atomic spy, was a good friend and protege of my thesis advisor, Rudy Piles, and the hearing of Fuchs's treason was a fairly traumatic experience, but it isn't clear whether it had told one anything in particular. Well, around 1950, I came to Cornell, and one thing you should understand about basic science funding in those days is that there was no National Science Foundation. So all of the nuclear lab, the people who got me the US visa, etc., all were from the Office of Naval Research. Now, there were other outfits, but essentially almost all the funding of basic science was Defense Department related. Later on, there was an interim period when the NSF already existed, but the best people and the most money were still in the ONR, and so in fact, the awareness of the National Science Foundation taking over basic research funding from the Defense Department really came to most people quite a bit after whenever it was founded. In effect, I have forgotten when the NSF was founded. I've told you some of the things I did experience. It's important also to realize some of the experiences I did not have just because of my age. I was 25 years old when I came here, and the thing I had not experienced was the Manhattan Project and Los Alamos. I assume you've all seen the the cartoon, which was on the notice to this meeting. I don't know if you can see it all. It's sort of already two different stories in one, so to speak. It's a modern-day student interviewing an old codger about days in the 60s, and it's up to you whether the guy interviewed was an activist or a war professor. But at any rate, the punchline is that the youngster says, "Oh God, I missed everything," when he gets his idea reinforced that the old days were very glamorous. Well, that essentially could also be a cartoon of my age group about 30 years ago, talking to the people who had indeed been in the Manhattan Project. So although none of us, I think, would admit it in public, part of this hankering after the glamour of being associated with big projects was probably somewhere at the back of our minds, although, as I say, none of us admitted it then and probably wouldn't now either. And it's one of those things where not many years separate you from having been there. Had we been 5 or 10 years older, you know, we probably would have been, and especially here at Cornell, the nuclear lab was founded by sort of two of the big shots from the Los Alamos days, Hans Bader and Bob Wilson, but also the, you know, the people who at Los Alamos were young had come back. They were about 10 years older than, you know, than my age group, and as I say, that must have had an impact on us. Well, sort of politics hit people of my age group in a big way just a few years after I came to Cornell, because of the Joe McCarthy era on sort of internal witch hunts and sort of a general military political scare on the other. And the Joe McCarthy era, at least to my way of reckoning, probably had its peak around about the 53-54 period. And one of the highlights of that peak, at least for scientists, were the Oppenheimer hearings, which sort of were dramatically about Oppenheimer security clearance. But of course, what was involved was the question of, you know, should we go from just A-bombs to H-bombs, increasing the power per weight by a large factor or not? And to at least us physical scientists, that to a large extent sort of seemed to be a debate between a few well-known super hawks within the scientific community, Edward Teller sort of being by far the most noticeable one then, and opponents on the other side, who however also were working within the military, of whom Cornell's Hans Bethe, and also my boss, the reason why I came to Cornell, etc., etc., was more or less the ringleader and the symbol. And, you know, I said it wasn't just a matter of the security clearance of one individual. It was a matter of whether you build the H-bomb or not. But it was more than that also. I mean, there was a concerted effort on the part of the super hawks to generally arrange things so the U.S. could fight a preventive war against the Soviet Union. Of course, you always clothe it in different terms of saying, I want to have the ability, the posture to do it, and if I do it, then the other side will get so scared that I won't, you know, need to actually carry it out. But nevertheless, I mean, the planning, the question was, should one be able to fight a preventive war? And obviously, having 100 times more nuclear tonnage would help in that regard. Well, I put it on the level of there having been sort of two opposing forces, I mean, two possible role models I might have had. But in fact, of people I knew well, I would say there were really three role models or possible ones. I mean, Edward Teller on the superhawk side, a scientist who both, you know, wanted to build up military posture and clearly wanted to work within the system. And then on the other side, another very influential professor in the same nuclear lab at that time was Phil Morrison, who had also worked on the Manhattan Project and so on during the war, but he had chosen already by that time to sort of go to the opposite extreme of Edward Teller. He was not only a Duff, but he chose to be a Duff fully outside of the military system. So in a way, I at least had the feeling that if you felt you wanted to be a hawk, I mean, that building up our military preparedness was what you felt was absolutely essential. You had little dilemma. If you sort of didn't agree with that, you clearly had a dilemma of whether to be a dove outside the system like Phil Morrison or sort of a dove working inside the system like Bader. Now, if you looked up the outcome of the hearings on Oppenheimer, he lost his clearance in the H-bomb. I mean, there was a decision to build the H-bomb, so you would think that at least in that instance, the Hawks won out, but in some ways that isn't really quite so true, because as I said, the real aim was a preventive war and to build up enough hysteria in the country on many things technical in order to lead the country into doing a preventive war, and that on that Teller and the other superhawks did not succeed. So essentially at that time, when I was not involved in really just looking at it from the outside, I decided that of those three possible role models, there was no doubt in my mind that Hans Bethe was the one, the middle road was the one that I felt I wanted to choose. Well, I was saying earlier, or at least I was asked, one of the questions is sort of how much sociology comes into just, what outfit you choose and who chooses you and so on. And there is quite a bit of that. I mean, the very first time I got my security clearance and started working for the military was just a few years later. Things happened pretty quickly. Joe McCarthy went from, the very zenith of his power to being almost completely out in a very short time. However, there was the time when there was a missile gap, or at least there was a supposed missile gap, that the Russians were ahead of us in re-entry physics or something or other about missiles. And there was another very influential Cornell professor, Arthur Kantrovitz, in the Aero School, who left Cornell to start a research lab whose main mission was indeed to do sort of research and development for the military having to do with intercontinental ballistic missiles. And there was sort of quite a number of youngsters, sort of roughly my age group, all Cornelians, most of them engineers, but not all. Many of whom went to actually work for AFCO, and a few of us, including myself, didn't actually work there permanently, but we would spend summers there. And the other sort of flavor I want to give you is that if you work for, one of these more or less think tank, I mean smaller research outfits, that coupling to the military is relatively small. I mean, first of all, you don't see people from Washington much, and number two, most of the things you work on are rather far removed from the real problems. I mean, for instance, I spent a large part of my time helping the guys there on an effort which never fully came off of writing a crash program, new textbook on sort of the modern kind of high temperature statistical mechanics, that was needed for understanding reentry physics. For a couple of years I worked somewhere else, but I don't think that didn't last very long. my main involvement, at least later, was called Jason, and I gathered, at least from Chris, that that sort of made the headlines, and people are interested in what that was like 25, 27 years ago. So I thought I would talk a little bit more about that. It was, to begin with, called Project Sunrise Safari, but just within a year it got the slightly a shorter name of Jason. So let me say a little bit of how it seemed to me that it was started, and of course it's one of those things where everybody associated with it has a completely different view of how it was started, one involving him or her more than, you know, some of the other views. So for instance, on my view, IDA doesn't enter at all. IDA stands for Institute for Defense Analysis, and eventually this outfit, Jason, you know, was on paper a division of IDA. The way it appeared to, you know, my age group is that in fact we were sort of a self-selected body of people who decide, whose history on defense consulting was a little bit like mine, of having worked for one or the other industrial outfit, and sort of felt there must be a way of getting a little bit closer to the decision-making process, or at least closer to the people who are supposed to do the final listening. And so that's the group which formed Jason. There's another piece of sociology which is not usually associated with Jason, but in fact I feel was sort of what made the selection of people, of names, what it was. Namely, it was just a little bit before this time and a little bit after that a Californian, Roger Revelle, was working very hard to start the University of San Diego in La Jolla and to build up a fancy a physics group. And one of the things he wanted to build up was what was then modern theoretical physics, which was essentially quantum electrodynamics. And he had the curious idea of more or less almost trying to get a group of youngsters to select each other. So a few of these names, Brückner in particular and Goldberger, and Ken Watson, sort of went around recruiting, I mean at least seemingly recruiting, people from their own peer group. And so there was a collection of names, these are maybe two-thirds of them, all pretty much the same age, all working on theoretical quantum electrodynamics, and all being wooed by University of California in La Jolla. And some of these names actually even went to La Jolla afterwards. But the interesting thing was that at least there was a group of people who talked to each other anyway for the possibility of all ending up in La Jolla. So it sort of happened very, very quickly that it suddenly became an organization working, at first at least, almost purely for the Defense Department, and mostly through an outfit called the Advanced Research Projects Agency. The other thing which I should have made clearer, which was different in those days from today, was the type of Secretary of Defense. And this was sort of, it spanned two presidents, but it had one defense secretary, Robert McNamara, who sort of epitomized the kind of people who try to work from within. I mean, he is a guy who was and is basically a dove, but he, you know, felt that one could work inside, and he was a pretty gifted man. He was to General Motors then what Lee Iacocca is to Chrysler today, and so he went from that job to being Secretary of Defense. And so there was an atmosphere of sort of technology and cost effectiveness, and it was a much more sort of scientific atmosphere inside the Defense Department than today. Now, as I'll come to in a minute, that same Defense Department also got us into Vietnam, but you know, things are never very simple. The other thing I should say about Jason was that essentially we would all get briefings on all sorts of things, but then we would sort of peel off one by one and pick some particular area of interest, and then usually we would just work on that for the next, you know, in years or so. And at a fairly early stage, I mean, this was 1960, there was already talk, at least, about anti-ballistic missile defense. I mean, in the first few years, not very loud talk, but there was some. The way we would usually operate, since we were all university professors, was to have long summer studies either at La Jolla or at Woods Hole, or sometimes other places. Well, I was going to tell you sort of what, you know, how one does decision making, and these things are often cued by quite irrelevant sounding things for yourself. I told you at quite an early stage already it was clear I was going to work on radar problems, at first radar backscatter from the ionosphere. My first job for the Advanced Research Project Agency had to do with the building of Arecibo, not, you know, with anything really having to do with Washington. But as I told you, we got briefings on all sorts of things. And amongst many other things, one of the things we got briefings on was chemical and biological warfare. And I think I had told you that I had already decided, at least in general, that I felt if you were a dove to work from inside the Defense Department at that time, you know, was most things the right thing to do. But I also had already felt that you have to reassess on each particular instance. And in particular, it became very clear to me very quickly that the caliber of the people and the work and the aims in the chemical and biological warfare division of the Army, that everything conspired to be on such an awful level that to me was something that clearly was an exception. I mean, that there was no way one could possibly do any good by, you know, even talking to these people. And so that was one instance where I felt, you know, one had to take the opposite tack and completely, you know, be purely a dove on the outside. And I had thought, you know, that most of my colleagues felt similarly, but that is never quite clear. Another thing which was completely unrelated to anything I had any expertise on or would ever work on were a lot of briefings on Vietnam by a very imaginative Frenchman with an English name, Bernard Faure. Now, I want you to remember I'm talking about the early 60s, at a time when most Americans did not know even that we were getting into a war. But remember, he was a Frenchman. He'd done his PhD thesis on the Vietnam War, which the French were losing. So, you know, he had been there a long time. And essentially, there was no doubt already at that time that he convinced us, or at least me, that Vietnam was hopeless. I mean, that we had lost the war already before it had even started. I mean, that there was a whole continuity from the French to us, that we had not learned any lessons, that we were going to not learn any lessons. And so, you know, the inevitability of a complete disaster in Vietnam was quite clear. And as I say, all that was before we knew we were in a war. By the time we knew we were in a war, Faure had already been killed in Vietnam. I feel, you know, it's not clear which side killed him, but anyway, he was killed. Well, another thing I want to point out, which is not that important for those days, but is sort of an interesting comparison between the McNamara Defense Department and the Weinberger Defense Department, and that has to do with the way you set up an organization trying to investigate some new project. And by the mid-60s, ABM was an important issue, just about like it is today. It was all terminal defense in those days rather than defense in the boost phase. But, you know, otherwise there were great similarities. But as I told you, McNamara was a very different kind of individual. He set up two organizations, one in the Army, one in the Air Force. The Army would get its brownie points for success with the defense against the ICBMs, and the Air Force would get its brownie points by inventing better countermeasures for the ICBMs. And so if you hear me under other circumstances talk about the great dishonesty in SDI today compared to ABM in the 60s, it's not necessarily that individuals were more honest in those days. It's just that there were these two opposing organizations that were able to keep each other honest, and a third organization, the one I worked for, namely the Advanced Research Project Agency, which to some extent was sort of an arbitrator of scientifically what was what. Well, as I told you, this ABM sort of started being at least a research outfit at a fairly early stage, and there's nothing very remarkable in this. It's just that many, even in those days already, there were many issues related to ABM, and radar was just one of many. Another point, just to illustrate that things were more technological in the Defense Department. We even had, in the mid and late 60s, a whole classified journal just to do with ballistic missile defense. So it was classified, but at least for inside the classified community, people had access to it, but also you went through all the rigmarole, I mean the tedium, but also the safeguards of having papers refereed. There were two anonymous referees who would have to referee your paper before it got published. So merely that the results were or were not expedient to your employer, Mr. McNamara, was not the major consideration for that. Well, I'm more or less getting close to the end, sort of for my own involvement. The sort of the culmination of essentially 3 years worth of work on essentially the same topics was a discrimination study report. I mean, then, as now, if you're interested in the mid phase or the terminal phase for defense against ICBMs, the main question is decoys. You can make 10 good decoys for each warhead and 100 sort of medium lousy decoys for each warhead, and so the whole game on the defense side is, can you discriminate a warhead from these decoys? So the sort of my heyday, I mean sort of the one huge thick report I came out with happened at just about the same time when sort of the final denouement of the whole ABM thing happened. And that itself is a sort of a peculiar thing where it is not quite clear whether it was a victory or a defeat for each side. I mean, there was a big debate as to whether to build ABM or not, and for many people, then as now, a debate like that does not depend on whether something is technically feasible or not, but just on whether politically it is expedient. But as I told you, the individual who was the defense secretary was rather different. So basically he was on the other side, but no one secretary of defense, you know, can to make everything go his way, and essentially the outcome was a very curious compromise, that the people who wanted ABM, of course, wanted an ABM against the Russians. I mean, they are the ones we would do a preventive war against, they're the ones we're scared of, etc. So there's obviously no doubt that if you needed ABM against anybody, it was the Russians and no one else. But essentially, McNamara at least listened to the technological reports, including mine, enough to be able to say there's no doubt that a well-prepared adversary, in particular the Russians or anybody else who had the same kind of technology, would be able to completely overcome any possible ABM system we had the money to do it.